This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Are you driving your car or doing laundry right now? Podcasts go best when they're bundled with another activity. Like Progressive home and auto policies, they're best when they're bundled too. Having these two policies together makes insurance easier and could help you save. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. Quote a home and car bundle today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On the Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to the Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
Listener supported, WNYC Studios.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and the New Yorker.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Much of the country is beginning to reopen at least some businesses and activities. A little later this hour, I'll talk with some of the mayors who are trying to negotiate how to do that without putting huge numbers of people at risk. But some restrictions are likely to extend through the summer and perhaps beyond. The prospect of that is daunting for everyone, not least for anyone with kids in the house. After months without going to school, the idea of keeping kids indoors, away from their friends, their sports, summer camps, and scouting trips, it seems like more than a parent can bear. But it's happened before and not that long ago.
I'm Jill Lepore. I'm a professor of history at Harvard. I'm also a staff writer at The New Yorker. And as a historian, I always think a lot about, well, is there comfort to be found in times in the past when people have had harder struggles and gotten through things? And immediately comes to mind for me the stay-at-home campaigns that were run during the polio years.
For all the boys and girls of the Northwest during radio's stay-at-home campaign. Now, listen.
Polio had first hit the U.S. in 1916, and some years were worse than others. A lot of viruses abate in the hotter months. But with polio, the warmer the weather, the virus spread faster, but also polio was most effectively transmitted by water. So in the summer when it got hot, this is before the age of air conditioning, kids would be outside wanting to go to swimming pools, jump in the river. And it's not like they have homeschooling assignments. It's the summer. Like, they're supposed to be outside playing catch and playing baseball and drawing hopscotch with chalk on the sidewalk. And it was really hard to keep them inside. And I came across this incredibly charming clip from WCCO in Minneapolis, which had a Sunday morning program called Fun at Home during the stay-at-home campaign.
Well, it's 9:05 and time for all you kids to gather around your radios and listen to the funnies. This morning we have an extra.
And they would do anything to be entertaining to kids. So this clip is from 1946, and it's the fairly young Democratic mayor, Hubert Humphrey. I mean, think of him maybe as the Andrew Cuomo of the moment, although more charming. He comes in, volunteers to come into the radio station on Sunday to read the funnies out loud.
We start right off with Blondie, and you know what? It looks like Blondie and Dagwood are going to go out on a fishing party. Toby, you got any fishing music over there?
Yeah, a little bit by the sea.
Yeah, that's good. That's fine. Oh, listen to that. Now, just take a look at that. There's Dagwood, kids, and there's Dagwood right along. There's he right alongside the lake shore there, and he says, I don't know why it is I can't catch a fish. Doesn't he look, oh, he just looks all down in the dumps, you know.
So, and he loves it. I mean, you can tell because he brings his kids with him. Like, he does voices and he tries to be Dagwood and Blondie. And his kids keep asking questions and they want him to read Popeye instead.
A can of worms there, and look at that funny hat on there, just like he's hunting lions. You see that, Skip? And he says,
I have one of them too.
Oh, you have a hat like that. And then Dagwood says, they pull out fish as fast as
and
they throw.
And when I first listened to this clip, maybe in the fall sometime. I was like, this, it's so adorable, and it's so sweet, and it's so quaint. But somehow the pathos of it didn't strike me.
Chocolate eclairs for bait. He just uses everything, but he can't catch anything. So there he goes.
One of the strange, maybe only blessings of the COVID pandemic is that kids seem to be, so far, less vulnerable to it. But with polio, it's exactly the opposite. For a long time, polio was called the baby plague, which is this heartbreaking name, just to think about that. What it does to know that your children, babies, toddlers, preschoolers, are the most vulnerable.
Fishing on private property, huh? Without a license, huh?
Is that a policeman?
Oh, that's a policeman, you betcha. Without a license.
And a long nose.
Oh, you got a long nose, yeah. I wonder who that's a funny-looking guy, all right.
Like, it didn't really hit me that this was a desperate measure. It just seemed to me adorable. And I listened to it again. I almost listened to Hubert Humphrey with what I think of as COVID ears. And it's still sweet. It's still charming. I still love listening to it. But it's also quietly desperate.
Mr. Humphrey, we're going to have a song by Toby Prince, the original sad sack song. Toby, take over with Put Your Arms Around Me. Cuddle up a little closer. Lovely, lovely mine. Cuddle up and be my little...
One of the reasons I study history is I like to see how things began so that I can imagine how bad things end. So there were good polio years and bad polio years, but the worst polio year in the United States was 1952. So a few years after Hubert Humphrey made that recording, reading the funnies, 58,000 Americans got infected. And it was also the year, though, that a young epidemiologist named Jonas Salk developed a vaccine.
A virus that causes polio has been successfully grown inside chicken eggs. This may lead to the development of a potent vaccine to prevent the dreaded disease.
A really promising vaccine, a really controversial vaccine, and it had to be tested. And then he began what became the largest field trial in the history of public health.
Even so, it was the largest such medical test ever attempted.
And finally, on this momentous day, April 12th, 1955, the beginning of spring.
Heading the medical men was Dr. Jonas Salk.
Summer's coming. It's going to be another hard polio year. People expected it to be a very hard polio year. The clock is ticking. The calendar is turning. Everybody wants that polio vaccine before the summer of 1955. And there's this quite incredible announcement it's made at the University of Michigan. Hundreds of reporters go there, and they printed out these press reports with all the details of the results of the field trial that they're going to announce.
Reporters pressed forward to get the results the whole world was waiting for. Rushed to their typewriters.
And the reporters are literally climbing over each other, trying to get to the copies of the press release, like so eager. I mean, you can imagine that now. It doesn't take a whole lot of imagining to imagine that now. If someone had a vaccine and we'd waited 18 months to know if it worked. And it works.
An historic victory over a dread disease is dramatically unfolded at the University of Michigan. Here, scientists usher in a new medical age with the monumental report.
I mean, just, you picture sort of a medieval turreted castle and the trumpeteers blowing their horns and the flags are, you know, the standards are being unfurled and... Like, there's just this, like, the vaccine works! And, you know, this kind of... And it's the relief, the joy, the exaltation, the exhilaration, the knowledge that this thing could end.
90% effective, and modest Dr. Salk answers newsmen's questions.
The great wealth of events that is accumulated in the experiences of so many is well represented in the report made this morning.
You often notice that people from different generations have these different timestamps in their early memories. Like, there are people whose first memory is of 1969 and watching the Apollo moon landing, or whose first memory is of 1963 and the assassination of John F. Kennedy. I remember for years when I would ask students what their first memory was of an event of global significance, it was 9/11. I grew up with the vaccine, but people not very much older than I am suffered from polio, watched polio knew people who suffered from polio. But my kids don't know anyone has had polio. I don't think they know how it works or how terrifying it was. And that's the great blessing of a vaccination program, right? Like, we forget how bad the disease was. But there's a generation of Americans whose most significant early memory is of waiting in line to get the Salk vaccine. I have a colleague who I once asked about this, and he said, oh, I can remember the taste of it in my mouth. It was like a sugar drop. It was almost like a lollipop. And my mother said, this will save your life. You will have a life. And I think about that, and I think about the generation of kids who we can only hope will remember the day that they go to get the coronavirus vaccine. And it will be their timestamp.
Staff writer Jill Lepore. Jill's new history podcast is called The Last Archive from Pushkin Industries, and it will include an episode about the fight against polio. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. More to come.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On The Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Offices, gyms, hair salons, churches, social gatherings, and more are starting to reopen. And even Andrew Cuomo of New York, who hasn't soft-pedaled this disaster, announced that some restrictions will be lifted this month as planned. But what constitutes safe reopening is controversial, particularly in the absence of clear national guidelines and the president's encouragement of protests against orders issued by state governors. To get a sense of how local leaders are managing the process, I called up the mayors of three cities, Chattanooga, Tennessee, Kansas City, Missouri, and Cheyenne, Wyoming. They've been spared the worst surge of COVID-19 deaths, but not the psychological pressure, the political upheaval, and the economic wreckage. Andy Burke of Chattanooga declared a state of emergency on March 13th. On April 20th, Burke said that the city would not commit to an arbitrary reopening date. But now the state of Tennessee is reopening, and Chattanooga right along with it. Mayor Burke, hello, how are you?
Good, how are you today?
Not bad. Now, the world has not seen anything like the COVID-19 pandemic in a century, at least. There's no playbook to follow. We all know that. And everybody seems to be improvising and adapting to the changes. How has the coronavirus changed your job as mayor?
Well, it's something I was completely unprepared to deal with, didn't expect it. We went from Chattanooga being the number one city in the country for new jobs, according to Forbes, to trying to prevent people from getting sick and handing out relief to people who need rent payments and businesses who are trying to survive.
Well, how badly has your city been affected in terms of the virus, in terms of illness and deaths?
Fortunately, we've been much better off than many places. We shut down things extremely early here. So as of the beginning of May, for example, we are the fourth largest county in Tennessee, but we only had 1.4% of the cases in our state. We've had 13 deaths, which is quite unfortunate, but our number of cases has not been nearly as large as in other places.
Now, recently, your governor, Bill Lee, decided to reopen the state. Did you agree with that decision?
I did not.
Tell me why.
Well, we had formed a economic restart group among the big four mayors in Tennessee. That's Nashville, Knoxville, Memphis, and Chattanooga. And we had an entire system set out that would say when we would reopen, the circumstances under which we would reopen, the things that would cause us to dial back, different phases, and so on. We essentially went from that to a full-scale reopen where virtually everything other than large-scale events is open on some level. We know that from the CDC guidelines, this is not the public health recommended way to do this, but the governor at the time put down an order saying that that no city mayor could control this issue, and instead, at least in our county, said only the county mayor had that authority.
Well, I'll be blunt. Do you think that this is a decision that's going to be paid for in human lives?
I'm extremely worried that it is. We're already seeing some numbers climbing. We can't let them get to the point where it's a logarithmic expansion. And for us to do that, we need testing for large groups of people on a frequent basis. We need to make sure that we're monitoring what our numbers are doing here locally. And this has got to be a nonstop activity at the front of our public policy.
Mr. Mayor, what's your responsibility at this moment? Is it to decide what you believe is best for your city based on consulting experts and scientists? Or is it to fulfill the mandate of the state government in Tennessee and what a large portion of your constituency is asking for and demanding?
Well, I believe that my mandate lies somewhere between those two because I have a legal duty to follow the mandates of our state. My other responsibilities, though, are to speak out for what I think is right for my residents. We do webinars with all of our industries. Yesterday, we had close to 200 child care providers on a webinar, plus close to 100 close contact business owners. So we're trying to do everything that we can to educate people and to speak out about what needs to happen. At the same time, I know that I have a legal obligation to follow what the governor says, and we're going to do that.
You know, when I ran for mayor and got elected, which was less than a year ago, I used to say that, you know, the president doesn't make that much of a difference in my daily life and our daily lives in Kansas City. I regret that I have to say that's not the case.
Quentin Lucas is the mayor of Kansas City, Missouri.
That weekend when the president finally said this is an important deal, things are going to be different. We should all have shelter in place or stay home orders. You saw it pretty much throughout the country with the exception of a few holdouts, Republican states, all those sorts of things, having these stay at home orders. But I think on the opposite way, as soon as the president tweeted, liberate Michigan, liberate Virginia and your Second Amendment, liberate Minnesota. Then we started seeing more of these protests in state capitals. I had a protest on the steps of my city hall here in Kansas City. You started seeing kind of this great level of acrimony between different forces. And I think you started seeing the repeal of stay-at-home orders a little faster than anyone would have recommended.
Well, tell me about those protests. What was the rhetoric that you were hearing? How representative were they?
You know, I like to think that they weren't that representative, but they were certainly loud. You know, they, in a time where the news is looking at data, which is, I'm always seeing it as actually deaths and tragedies, but, you know, I think people wanted to look at something that was different than a number. Instead, they saw a bunch of people with don't tread on me flags and, you know, who had bullhorns and were saying zany, in some ways, really bizarre, off-the-wall things. You know, prior to this time in life, I'd never been compared to Adolf Hitler. I don't think in any way the steps that I'm taking or any governor in our country is taking is anything that is dramatic other than trying to save lives. And, you know, it's been frustrating to see that. So I think they've been more effective than their size has let on.
Forgive me, Mr. Mayor, I just want to be clear on this point. You seem to be connecting the insults that have been directed at your way. I think you've been described as Nazi-like in how you've instituted restrictions in the city. And you're drawing a line between being called a Nazi and the rhetoric from the White House.
I am. I do think that there is a connection to where we are. I think as we've unleashed some level of total detachment from, I think, science and understanding why rules are being issued in the way they are, I think you have seen an increase in very negative sentiment. You know, some on the left have said that now that all of our efforts aren't stern enough, that we, you know, that there's blood on my hands. So I guess it's a two-way street.
Beyond rhetoric, what kind of practical problems has the White House created for you, has Donald Trump created for you as you try to manage Kansas City's daily life?
I think there is an inconsistency in messaging that we have right now. I'm one who has a concern with the fact that, you know, we're trying to say that wearing a mask is important. And the day that the president announced wearing a mask, he said, you know, I'm not going to wear one. And, you know, some people say you need it. Some people don't. Do what you will. It is shocking sometimes how many people that may not even subscribe politically to the president's viewpoint still listen to him, still listen to what he says, and then still, particularly some of our younger people, model that level of behavior. I think the fact that those of us here in cities, particularly where our states are not giving us much guidance, are looking for what are good rules for reopening schools, what are rules for summer student activities, swimming pools, that sort of thing. And I think the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention has been muzzled. Basically, what I've heard is that we should reopen from Washington. And that's kind of the only consistent message we've gotten. And sometimes you certainly want to sit back and say, can I just get some clear guidance from someone else so that I'm not exchanging text messages with superintendents in the Kansas City suburbs about, well, you know, can we have events in August or can we not? It's not clear. We don't know. The CDC says one thing, but we heard something different. The World Health Organization, is that even a credible organization now because we've heard them attacked in the White House? I mean, it's frustrating and it matters and it gets down to everyday decisions that mayors of small towns and big cities are making all across our country.
How do you go about being mayor? You don't have all the usual instruments available to you, ribbon cuttings, meeting with people. So how do you go about communicating with people and staying in touch with your community and getting people to do what you think is necessary?
You know, we've done a lot more outreach to press than I think I ever had ever wanted, really. You know, I have a weekly segment on a hip hop station here in Kansas City to try to reach a crowd that may not catch me on, you know, our national public radio affiliate. I have a weekly segment on Spanish language radio. We continue through social media, through pretty much everything we can to get people to recognize how important the moment is and how we're not doing this as part of some sort of vast left-wing conspiracy to keep them indoors. And so that's, you know, the nature of what we do each day, but it certainly has changed. I mean, I'm an inner city politician, right? And a lot of my trajectory to being mayor of Kansas City was going to black churches every Sunday, which is something I don't do, but I get to talk to ministers still. I try to make sure I message with them, and we'll keep doing that for as long as this crisis is around.
Mayor Lucas, thank you so much. And I wish you and Kansas City all the very best.
Thank you.
Marion Orr is the mayor of Cheyenne, Wyoming. It's the largest city in the state, and her county has seen over 100 confirmed cases of COVID-19. Mayor Orr, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Now, how bad has your community been hit in terms of economic terms? How do you quantify that?
Well, we are having daily budget discussions. Our budget is due June 1st, and we have absolutely been... we've been devastated. And unfortunately, for not only my community, but for Wyoming, this couldn't have come at a worse time because Wyoming is so heavily dependent on the coal industry and oil and gas. And seeing oil prices in the negatives devastates our economy. And then to have sales and use tax plummet, we're seeing a 30% decrease in revenue, and we don't see it coming back anytime soon.
Now, mayors are often cheerleaders for their city. They should be. And you're often urging people to come to your city, come to Wyoming, and spend money. But right now, you found yourself in a position where you've had to do the opposite, discouraging some of your out-of-state neighbors from coming and visiting. What's that change been like?
Well, it's been very difficult. We're only 25 miles away from Colorado in Weld County, which has seen a very large number of cases. And we are one of the few states that did not issue a shelter in place, a stay at home. And what we witnessed several weeks ago was the weather started to get better, and we saw folks from Colorado coming up and purchasing out-of-state, you know, non-resident fishing licenses and camping in our parks. And unfortunately, we had to do a shutdown on that. And my message has been, hey, we love you to come visit. Come visit Wyoming. It's a great place. But we just ask for a little bit of patience, and we can't wait to welcome everybody back in.
So tell me about the policy of not doing sheltering in place. Why not?
Well, it came from our governor, who took direction from our state health officer. Out here in Wyoming, we kind of maybe pride ourselves in the fact that many of us have been socially distancing before any of us really knew the phrase. We're very rural. I mean, our entire state's population is less than 600,000. We've really had to follow the lead of the governor and take a really unified approach as far as how the state operates.
Now, I wonder, as a Republican and as a citizen, and you're watching President Trump in Washington, what do you think of his messaging? What do you think of it when he says, liberate Michigan, for example?
Well, I'll be honest, I've had to turn it off because it's... And perhaps it's because I'm dealing with my own issues here. We certainly have had protests here in Cheyenne at the Capitol, you know, the right to assemble. I think that really harsh rhetoric is not what we need right now. We need we don't need politics. And this virus, not only does it not have a date, but it's bipartisan. It's not a Republican and it's not a Democrat. And we really need to, I think, communicate as leaders in a very mindful and using the medical expertise that we have available to us.
Now, the coronavirus has placed a huge strain on the city's budget. There's an $8 million deficit now, which is a big deficit for your city. What plan do you have? What plan can you possibly have to get the city back on track financially at this point?
Well, with most city budgets, our largest expense is payroll. And so, unfortunately, we've had to furlough 16 employees. We have not filled 15 positions that were open. We have roughly 400 and some employees. So that's really a pretty significant number. We are also looking at probably not hiring additional police and additional fire even though we're a growing population. So certainly payroll is top of the mind. One of the things that we talked about today was that even in City Hall, we don't need square footage. We need technology. We need to be spending money towards technology because so much work can be done from home, we've learned. We don't need this massive building with HVAC issues and, you know, electrical costs and we need technology.
So in other words, in a very profound way, the virus is going to change municipal life, not just for a little while, but maybe permanently.
I believe it absolutely shall. Perhaps the way we do business and deliver government services shall be changed forever.
Mayor Orr, thank you very much and all the very best to your city.
Thank you very much.
That's Marion Orr, the mayor of Cheyenne, Wyoming. We also heard from Quentin Lucas, mayor of Kansas City, Missouri, and Andy Burke of Chattanooga, Tennessee. I'm David Remnick. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour.
David, hi.
Anthony, this is your first Zoom call?
This is my first Zoom call, and maybe my last, you know. Evie had to help, so that's what children are for.
Usually when I get a recommendation from one of our writers, it's something like, here's three good history books to take to the beach, or here's everything you need to know about SoundCloud rap. But when I called Anthony Lane the other day, he just finished a binge of movies about plague and pandemics. How many films did you watch or watch part of?
As many as I could get hold of, I suppose about 20 or 30. And those are the ones that which are basically about disease comes into a lot of movies, but it doesn't hang around. But in fact, one of the first signs that the pandemic of pandemic movies was starting to happen was when everybody started to watch Contagion again, which is the Steven Soderbergh film.
Now, do you rank Contagion pretty highly?
I do. I mean, people now saying, oh, I liked it all along, whereas in fact they weren't that keen in the first place. But now it's very hard to watch in a stand-back way, because you do tend to sit there and go, that's right, they do that, but that's exactly what you do, you know. Don't touch that credit card.
Did this one make your top three or four?
Oh, yeah.
So let's listen to a little excerpt.
Yeah, this is Contagion.
Hello?
Hello? Mr. Barnes?
Yes.
This is Dr. Mears from the Centers for Disease Control. I believe you may have had contact with Beth Emhoff last week.
Yeah, I picked her up at the airport. What's this about?
How are you feeling today?
Pretty cruddy, to be honest. Head is pounding. I probably picked up some sort of bug.
Where are you right now?
I'm on the bus, heading to work.
I'd like you to get off immediately.
Wait, what? What's going on?
Where's the bus, Aaron?
Lake and Lindale. Can you tell me what's
Lake
going on?
Lake and Lindale. I really need you to get off that bus. Listen, it's quite possible you've come in contact with an infectious disease and that you're highly contagious. Do you understand? I want you to get off now and stay away from other people.
No, what do I do?
Don't talk to anyone. Don't touch anyone. That's the most important thing. We'll send somebody to meet the bus.
Okay.
I'm on my way to you now, Aaron.
Looks like he gave the disease to about 14 people on the way off the bus, coughing, gripping the pole.
Yeah, the pole, it is very clever in the way that it's very good on surfaces, and it educates you into things that we do know now anyway. But that actually counts as one of the more relaxing parts of the film, I'd say, you know. But there is one of the strange things about the film is that it's very scary, it's well put together, but it can't resist the upswing at the end. It can't resist the finding of the vaccine by the brilliant young scientist, and given what care the rest of the film has taken to try and reproduce the ways in which these things actually do pass and mutate, it doesn't pay much attention in the end to what a search for a vaccine is going to look like. It's an interesting case of the Hollywood ending needing to improve on life rather than reproduce its every fear.
Anthony, is there a second film that we should look at?
There's about 20 other films you'd look at, but I think there's one going back a long, long way. And this is Faust. Faust from 1926, directed by F.W. Murnau. I was watching this thinking it would be a historical, you know, curiosity. But Murnau, he was making it in the shadow of the recent Spanish flu. So people actually had been thinking about plague not long before. Plague plays a major part in it, because one of the first things that happens is that Mephisto, who's taken in a proper life and death struggle with archangels, has said, look, I can strike this town down. Let's see how we go. So what he does is to bring plague into a town. There's a wonderful famous image of Mephisto looming over this little German town. And the plague creeps in. We see the plague creeping in, and people starting to keel over from it. And what's interesting, of course, is we see people having fun when the plague strikes. You know, you see, as in all medieval films, people do nothing but tumble and do acrobatics. But the idea of this idea of fun being cut short, people are always enjoying themselves when the plague strikes. It's therefore, there's a biblical sense that of possible vengeance, that you have earned this by being irresponsible citizens. Faust is in some ways indebted to that, but it becomes, as always with Murnau, as in Nosferatu, which he'd made a few years before, he's very interested in the way that darkness can creep upon us, and also in the way that light can flare out and defeat it. Faust, who's thought of as a wise man with skills and medical skills in the town, is asked to come and help. and then says that he can't help. The plague is insuperable. He would need to have greater powers. Cue the powers. And so, in other words, the deal with the devil is made for quite altruistic reasons. He wants to be the sort of person who can cure a plague, which I think has a certain twist to it in the first place. If there is a movie, I think, which, after having trawled through quite a fair number of these, if there is a movie that you should see because it's in itself a good movie, regardless of the circumstance in which we find ourselves, that's Panic in the Streets, the Alakazam movie from 1950.
Herewith recorded is the story of a silent, savage menace. How for 3 days a great American city found itself outside the United States of America. The events, incidents, and emotions of the people who were a part of it, who found time running out as they looked into the face of mortal peril.
So it's before Streetcar and before On the Waterfront, but he's already interested in working people and in their ordinary lives. And that matters a great deal in the film. So a guy comes ashore from a boat in New Orleans, and he's shot and dies. But at the autopsy, they realize, in fact, he's had pneumonic plague. It then becomes, you've got to find the baddie who shot him, not just because he's committed a crime, but because he may be infectious. And if the baddie, in this case, is played by Jack Palance, you're thinking, uh-oh. Jack Palance, he's basically like the virus just in a black shirt. I mean, he's sort of, you know, he doesn't look like he's uninfected in the first place. He's infected with, you know, with being Jack Palance. And so Richard Widmark, who's the doctor with the public health, comes in, finds that, and starts to immediately take action. And the really interesting twist is the extreme skepticism that Widmark shows towards public information. Because in this case, if you publicize it, Jack Palance is going to skip town. So there's quite a lot about press freedom, interestingly, in this. And Widmark is fantastic because he's doing good in the film, but he's not a do-gooder. And when he tells people off for kind of thinking in too naive a way, as he does, politicians and mayors and other and cops and so forth, he does so with a kind of sneer and a snarl, as if he really means this. And he knows, because he knows what's at stake. So it stops the film from becoming sappy. I think we're going to see a clip.
And there's no reason for panic.
Our only chance for full cooperation, Clint, is to inform the public.
You agree?
No. The minute he prints it, the men we're looking for will leave the city. Now, I've told you once and I'll tell you again. Anyone leaving here with plague endangers the entire country.
The entire country hasn't got it. We have. A woman died here last night. This problem lies right here in our own community.
Community? What community? Do you think you're living in the Middle Ages?
Oh, come now.
Anybody that leaves here can be in any city in the country within 10 hours. I could leave here today and I could be in Africa tomorrow. And whatever disease I had would go right with me.
I know that.
Then think of it when you're talking about communities. We're all in a community, the same one.
Wow, that is resonant.
What is the upshot of watching all these films?
In all honesty, I thought there were some wonderful films here, and saw some wonderful bits of films as well. But I also, because inevitably you sit there comparing it with the experience we're all going through in our various ways at the moment, you sit through thinking, well, where's the lockdown bit? Where's the boredom bit? Where's the confusing public signals? Where's our experience of this? Where's the thing when you can't go across town and see your aged parent or the kids can't see their grandparents? There's almost none of that. I can see why, because watching 2 hours of people in a household not getting on with each other, you know, who wants more of that at the moment?
You can get that at home.
You can get that at home, exactly so.
Let's let the real life movie end soon so we can watch these.
Exactly, so we can all go out to an actual movie theater and get lots of health-giving sodas. And then, because, you know, James Bond has already been delayed once. It's supposed to be November, and if it's any longer than that,
we've suffered enough.
I need James Bond in November, come what may.
Anthony Lane, thank you so much.
Thank you so much, David.
Anthony Lane is The New Yorker's film critic, and you can read his essay, Our Fever for Plague Movies, at newyorker.com. More to come.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Gia Tolentino is a staff writer and the author of last year's bestseller, Trick Mirror. Music is one of Gia's great passions, and for years she's been following Mike Hadrius, who records under the name Perfume Genius. He has an album just out called Set My Heart on Fire Immediately. Gia Tolentino talked with Perfume Genius recently.
Yeah, I mean, first, like, how are you? What's the vibe like?
I don't know. I got the hardest part is that I had envisioned this whole way that this was supposed to go, and even visually how I was going to feel, how I was going to be, you know, that required people and it required being
right
outside and it required leaving. And so now I'm trying to figure out a way, how can I have yeah. that same energy, but just like with in my bedroom or something.
I've been a fan of Perfume Genius for a long time. I remember listening to his first album, which was called Learning. Learning came out in 2010, and I think that one of the songs that people still talk about from it is the third track, Mr. Peterson. It's a really sad song. It's about a relationship with a teacher.
He let me smoke weed in his truck. If I could convince him I loved him enough.
And things get really dark, but the song almost, like, it sounds like Seven Swans era Sufjan Stevens. It sounds like Here Comes the Sun, sort of this really, really intimate, really carefully written bedroom pop. He sounded different then than he does now. His new album is called Set My Heart on Fire Immediately, and it's a rock album. There are a couple of songs in it that seem to reference this 50s Roy Orbison, Elvis kind of thing. There's kind of a 90s grunge sound. One of the 50s leaning songs is Whole Life. And it begins with this sort of beautiful instrumental that then breaks into the vocals where he's singing in this like almost swaggering way.
Half of my life is done.
I kind of was inhabiting classic ideas and classic ways of singing. And
yeah.
That felt really satisfying, but there's also this like undercurrent of something else or something supernatural or, you know,
uh-huh.
kind of trying to meet those two things.
Yeah, I mean, the sort of Elvis-y thing that you're yeah. doing a lot on the album. Like, as you were writing for this album, as you were putting it together, what was, like, can you tell me more about feeling that vibe build, that sort of, those sort of like old Americana structures?
I think a lot is just because that's music I've listened to my whole life. I still carry it around all the time, but felt like there was always not completely room for me in the music.
Yeah.
But inhabiting that specific like map and like the swagger of some of that singing and how they're like be really ultra vulnerable, but also like have this really intense command and like confidence uh-huh. at the same time felt good. And it felt good to be singing about the things I care about.
Don't you know you're queen?
Perfume Genius's real name is Mike Hadrius. He is now 38. And the world of his music is a sort of implicitly and explicitly queer universe. One of the songs that I think he's best known for is the song Queen off of the album Too Bright. At one point he sings, "Don't you know you're queen? Cracked, peeling, riddled with disease." It's this playful, like sumptuous kind of rejoinder to these narratives about queer bodies. And it's this like lush, like incredibly strong taunt. It's amazing.
Do you find it, like classifying your music as queer art, do you find that reductive or do you find that like essential?
It's essential to me, but and I have no problem with that at all. Other people do. And I don't want that to be like a barrier to me being able to have other people listen to it. I mean, it's just the flip side to everything. It's like I talk about the emotional content of my music all the time. And then I feel like sometimes that is like a sacrifice to how smart and technical and like actually deliberately I'm making this good music. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But at the same time, the emotional content is honestly way more important to me. And being a queer musician and that idea and talking about those things is way more important to me.
Yeah, I was reading something in an interview where when you were talking about kind of the freedom of not, like kind of desiring the freedom of not needing to convince people of your right and the ability to do what you're already doing.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, it's even like it bleeds into my daily life where I just want to grab like 10 people and like move to like buy a big ranch and live with them and just make our own world. But then I'm leaving behind a bunch of people that don't have the luxury of leaving, like, you know, and I need to stay and be helpful to the people that can't just like, you know, go to the desert and roll around with me.
So I interviewed Hadrius actually before his last album, No Shape, came out. And I still remember this, you know, something he told me at that interview, which is that when he was a young teenager, the world gave him this idea of himself that he found really hard to shake. He was the only openly gay student at his high school. He was bullied pretty brutally. He was beat up. And he dealt with a lot of trauma. And there's this really interesting way in which you can see his whole trajectory as a musician as a way of processing and getting free of this trauma. The first albums were very inward. They were cathartic and, you know, all the pain was right there on the surface and that's what it was. Too Bright, the third album, you started to hear him become defiant. And then his last album, No Shape, which came out in 2017, it felt like this really profound breakthrough. And it began with this song called Other Side that contains this almost surprise moment of exaltation and joy in a way that hadn't really come into his music before. It was like watching a chandelier shatter when that moment kicks in.
I feel like every record is kind of like aspirational. Like, I wanted to be really like more liberated and free, but it was kind of aspirational that I wanted those feelings. And so I was thinking about them and reaching for them. And now I kind of feel like that more.
Yeah. In a couple of interviews, you talked about that like kind of 12-year-old idea of yourself being so kind of sticky that like for a while it prevented you from seeing either how you've changed or how the world's changed, that you know, this image was just sort of dominant. And I was wondering if you still feel like that, if you still feel like those, do you feel all of those selves with you?
I think I feel all those phases less now than I used to, and consciously maybe. I think I felt like I had to keep them all like heavy on my mind to try to warm them up and soften them and make them feel better for a while. And I don't really feel like I need to do that anymore.
Do you think about how you want your music to make people feel? Or do you just let that happen?
I do. I mean, I want them. I mean, I guess I want them to feel like I do. But then because it's been so freeing for me to like if I make a song where two things that are competing are existing at the same time, and I've been told my whole life that I have to just pick one, but then I make like 4 minutes where they can be just next to each other.
Yeah.
I mean, it doesn't fix anything or solve anything, but it just makes you feel less lonely for 4 minutes. Yep. And that's what I hope.
Can you give me an example of those two things that would be?
I mean, like the last song on this record is very sad. It's probably, to me right now, the saddest song that I've ever made. But I mean, there's some sweetness and hope to it. I mean, the whole idea of that song is that all the stuff that I think I'm reaching for and trying to access and longing for and trying to go to, what if it's ultimately nothing?
No God, not this time.
Like, I wasn't anywhere before this and I'm not going anywhere after, you know? But also in that song is that other people are with me. And if this is all there is, then, you know, I want to be with you.
Just be here, Jamie.
There's this okayness to it not being okay.
There's this sense throughout this whole new album of Hadria sort of willing himself into an equilibrium in the midst of things that might feel chaotic or uncontrollable or sad. And, you know, there's a very obvious correspondence between that movement, that sort of movement and that sort of effort and the kind of experience of being alive right now. There is this sense, I think, for all of us that, you know, all we have is what's in front of us. All we have are the little moments of kindness that other people are extending to us and that we can extend to other people. And it's got to be enough.
Staff writer Gia Tolentino talking with Mike Hadrias, who records as Perfume Genius. His new album is Set My Heart on Fire immediately.
Now rest your hand in.
I'm David Remnick, and thanks for joining us this week. See you next time.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Merrill Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. This episode was produced by Alex Barron, Emily Botine, Ave Carrillo, Rhiannon Corby, Kalalia, David Krasnow, Caroline Lester, Gofen Mputubwele, Louis Mitchell, Michelle Moses, and Stephen Valentino, with help from Allison McAdam, Morgan Flannery, Danny Bonner, Mengfei Chen, and Emily Mann. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.